The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So, who's read Democracy in America, really? All of it? Wow, there you go. See, I thought everyone had read all of it, but then I discovered among all my very well-read friends, most of them had read bits in college. And then I sort of figured that they'd been taught the good bits. Anyway, that's neither here nor there, but I spend a lot of time worrying needlessly about everybody's great knowledge of Tocqueville. And anyway, it's not at all necessary to enjoy this book, but it was obviously important to me because what I was set on doing was, well, I was, you know, I've been living in this country for 20 years and, you know, I'm a citizen, but I'm also a citizen of that other place, Australia. And there's a part of me that still feels rather foreign, and at the same time I'm really, really daily intimately involved with this country and the politics of this country and the culture of this country. And so, and like many of us over the last few years, I've been sort of frightened and angry, and wasn't really an Australian reaction, I think. Sorry, whoops. And it was, I really started to know Tocqueville through that little, because he's quoted by everyone. You sort of come across him, been quoted here and there for everybody for all sorts of reasons. And so finally I started to read Democracy in America. And the thing that was wonderful for me, and that's sort of an obsession of mine, was when you find somebody, well, I found Tocqueville, this French aristocrat, in about 1831, worried about all the same things that I was worried about now. And it was sort of really fascinating. And of course he was very snobbish. Everyone seems to think Tocqueville wasn't snobbish. I insist that the snobbish bits weren't taught in school. But he was a person of his class, and he's a French aristocrat. And of course it looks vulgar. You know, and being an Australian, believe me, you know, we are really used to people from other countries, in our case, the English, coming to patronise us half to death. And when I see part of Tocqueville do exactly the same thing, it seems very, very familiar and amusing, because sometimes in his sort of, I won't quite say disdain, but his amusement at American foibles, he also got things sort of rather right sometimes. The way I grew up, because we Australians did begin in a certain way, as we began with a penal colony, so we believe, I think, very deeply that we are all, anything is possible, we can be anything. And even if our national beginning was rather unfortunate, to put it mildly, have we not demonstrated that we can be who we want to be? So when you read someone like Tocqueville worried about the tyranny of the majority, you tend not to like him for doing that. But what I understood in the end, as I understood, I read him more and more, I saw that actually what Tocqueville could see and what he was afraid of was Sarah Palin. Really. So I thought, this is really interesting. And so one has to engage with oneself about what one thinks about democracy and whether, because I guess if I'd been arguing with Tocqueville, I would have imagined an educated electorate, not the uneducated majority, and we would have differed. And I would have said, in a democracy, we would all be educated, and so you don't need to fear the majority because they're not stupid. And then the other thing that, you know, I'm sure most people here, you know, you're thinking daily about the culture that we swim in, which in lower company than this, I would say, would be like swimming in a sea of crap, that, you see, Tocqueville also worries about exactly this thing, about what sort of culture this new country can have when everything's driven by the forces of the market. And you can read Tocqueville and you can sort of imagine hedge fund managers, you know, wrestling in the mud to decide who's going to pay the most money for an Andy Warhol, you know. I mentioned that because of Philadelphia, of course. Now, if I was going to really be clever and really ingratiate myself with you guys or make a fair go of it, there's quite a bit of the book that's set in Philadelphia. But I can't sort of be changing my reading that much. I don't know what to do. So I'm not going to read to you too much about Philadelphia, but as you, I might find a little bit. But you know, Tocqueville came to investigate prisons, and he came with Beaumont too to the Eastern State Penitentiary, and it was very interesting to have different points of view on that particular visit, and that's in this book. All right, where's my water? I think I've wasted enough time rambling, have I? I shall just read you some stuff. So basically, my character is not Tocqueville. And the real Tocqueville came to the United States with his aristocratic friend, Beaumont. And they argued and talked about democracy in America as they traveled. I know you can imagine them talking every night and every day. And they produced three books. But I wanted an argument about democracy with two different points of view. And I didn't want to solve anything because I was of course, if I'd solved it, I wouldn't be wasting my time here tonight. But this is not a conversation between two aristocrats. It's a conversation between this one French aristocrat who's called Olivier de Garmont and an older English servant who's a son of an itinerant printer and who's something of a picaro in a way. And they really sort of despise each other. And when Parrot, talking about Olivier, sort of refers to him as Lord Pintledy Pantledy and Lord Migraine and is generally sort of outraged by him and his class and so on. But let me begin with Olivier, and I think the one... I'm not a historian, clearly. I make stuff up, obviously. But I do try and sort of hit the chalk points in history. And also in beginning to invent this character, I realised that Tocqueville himself had been the child of survivors of the Terror. And this seemed to me a really substantial point because if you think of people who are the survivors of huge social trauma, it lasts through the generations and the children suffer and so on. So if you started to think about de Tocqueville in this way, all the things that he writes and says make a certain sort of sense. And I couldn't find anything in any of many books about Tocqueville that made an issue of this at all, which rather surprised me. And it was sort of one of the ways I started to build the character. And I was talking a couple of days ago to Leo Damroche, the guy who's just written this new book on Tocqueville, who said, yes, you're quite right, it's in my book. But it hasn't been there before. So this is Olivier. I had no doubt that something cruel and catastrophic had happened before I was even born. Yet the Comte and Comtesse, my parents, would not tell me what it was. As a result, my organ of curiosity was made irritable and I grew into the most restless, unhealthy creature imaginable, slight, pale, always climbing, prying into every drain and attic in the Chateau de Barfleur. But consider this. Given the ferocity of my investigations, is it not half queer I did not come upon my uncle's celery fair? Celery fair? Perhaps the celery fair was common knowledge in your own family, in mine it was like everything, a mystery. This clumsy wooden bicycle, constructed by my uncle Astolphe de Barfleur, was only brought to light when a pair of itinerant slaters glimpsed it strapped to the rafters. Why it should be strapped, I do not know, nor I can imagine why my uncle, for I assume it was he, had used two leather dog collars to do the job. It's my nature to imagine a tragedy that loyal pets have died, for instance, but perhaps the dog collars were simply what my uncle had at hand. In any case, it was typical of the riddles trapped inside the Chateau de Barfleur. At least it was not me who found it, and it makes my pulse race even now to imagine how my mother might have reacted if I had. My mother's upsets were never predictable. As for her maternal passions, these were not conventionally expressed, although I relished those occasions, by no means infrequent, when she feared that I would die. It is recorded that in the year of 1809, she called the doctor on 53 occasions. 20 years later, she would still be taking the most outlandish steps to save my life. This, in fact, we'll understand later, is him being packed off to America to get him out of the way of what would finally be was the July Revolution, the consequences of the July Revolution in 1830. So here, if you had the page, or if we had a PowerPoint, I could put up there. Oh, a picture of this wooden bicycle, but it's here and it's on page 4. My childhood was neither blessed nor tainted by the celery fair, and I would not have mentioned it at all, except here it is before us now. Typically, the Austrian draftsman fails to suggest the three dimensions. However, could there be a vehicle more appropriate for the task I have so recklessly set myself, and one that you, by the by, have supported by taking this volume in your hands? That is, you have agreed to be transported to my childhood, where it will be proven, or if not proven, then strongly suggested, that the very shape of my head, my particular phrenology, the volume of my lungs, was determined by unknown pressures brought to bear in the years before my birth. So let us believe that a grotesque and antique bicycle had been made available to us, its wooden frame in the form of a horse. And of course, if we are to approach my home this way, we must be prepared to push my uncle's hobby across fallen branches through the spinneys. It is almost useless in the rough ground of the woods where I and the Abbé de Lalande, my beloved bébé, shot so many hundreds of larks and sparrows that I bruised my little shoulder blue. Careful, Olivier, dear. Do be careful. We can ignore nose bleeding for the time being, although, to be realistic, the blood can be anticipated soon enough. Spectacular spurts, splendid gushes, my body being always too thin-walled a container for the passions coursing through its veins. But as we are making up our adventure, let us assume there is no blood, no compresses, no leeches, no wild gallops to drag the doctor from his breakfast. And so we readers can leave the silky, treacherous Seine and cross the rough woodlands and enter the path between the linden trees. And I, Olivier Jean-Baptiste de Clairel de Barfleur de Gaumont, a noble of myopia, am free to speed like Mercury while pointing out the blurry vegetable gardens on the left, the smudgy watercolour of orchard on the right. Here is a village road across which I can go sailing, skidding, blind as a bat through the open gates of the Chateau de Barfleur. Hello, Jacques. Hello, Gustave. Odile. I'm home. So, that's the beginning of the book. And by the end of the book, end of this chapter or whatever we shall call it, this compartment of storytelling, this child who's grown up smelling the secret of the trauma of the terror, who doesn't know what a guillotine is, who doesn't know what happened, and, does know, and he will do. I won't tell you what, why, how. No, that would be destructive. So that now, then maybe I might introduce to you Parrot, and then we'll see what we do next. After that, not much to say. This, as he's older, Parrot's a young boy at the beginning too, But the year is, as you'll see, it's the year of the terror. So this is 1793 in England. And I can't do that lovely West Country, lovely Devon sort of accent. And so you're going to have to put up with this. I'm sorry. You might think, who is this? And I might say, this is God. And what are you to do? Or I might say, a bird. Or I could tell you, madam, monsieur, sir, madam, how this name was given to me. I was christened Parrot because my hair was coloured carrot, because my skin was burnt to feathers, and when I tumbled down into the whaler, the coxswain yelled, here's a parrot, captain. So it seems you have your answer, but you don't. I'd been named Parrot as a child, when my skin was still pale and tender as a maiden's breast, and I was still Parrot in 1793, when Olivier de Barbar Garmont was not even a twinkle in his father's eye. To belabour the point, sir, I was and am distinctly senior to that unborn child. In 1793, the French were chopping off each other's heads, and I was already 12 years of age, and my endodermis naturalis had become scrubbed and hardened by the winds and mists of Dartmoor, from whose vastness my Da and I never strayed too far. I had tramped behind my darling Da down muddy lanes, and I was still called Parrot when he, Jack Larratt, carried me on his shoulder through Northgate at Totnes. My daddy loved his parrot. He would sit me on the bar of the Kingsbridge Inn to let the punters hear what wonders came from my amazing mouth. Man is born free and is everywhere in chains. Well, if that ain't worth sixpence, what is? My daddy was a journeyman printer, a lanky man with big knees and nubbly knuckled hands with which he would rough up his red hair when looking for first principles. Inside this bird's nest, it was a surprise to find his small white noggin, the precious engine of his bright grey eyes. And then there's a long quote from Rousseau, it turns out, about the relationship between children and their parents. And I get bored reading it to you, but it works on the page. It's just not good to read it out loud. My daddy and I were two peas in a pod. The acquisition of knowledge was our occupation. But of my ma, I knew nothing except that she had a tiny waist which would fit inside her husband's hands. I missed her all my life. I knew Adam Smith before I reached fractions. Then I was put to Latin, which my father liked no more than I did, and this caused us considerable upset, both with ourselves and with each other. It was due to Latin that my father got in a state and clipped my lug hole, and I grabbed a half-burned bit of kindling and set to drawing on the floor. I'd never seen a drawing in my life, and when I saw what I was doing, dear God, I thought I had invented it. And what rage, what fury, what a delicious humming wickedness I felt, all over the floor, and who will clean it? I'd seen my daddy's hand reach for his belt buckle, and I'd seen my daddy's hand reach for his belt buckle, and I was ipso facto ready for the slap. Yet at this moment, I entered a foreign jungle of the soul. I drew a man with a dirty long nose, a leaping trout, a donkey falling upside down. And my daddy's belt stayed in his trousers. He stared at me. His hair stood up like taffy. He cocked his head. I permitted him to take my charcoal stick and kiss me on the head. Not a cross word, or a kind one. He led the parrot downstairs, where he ordered the landlord pour me a ginger beer. Then he sat and watched me drink. And what was he pondering, do you reckon? Why, the benefits of having an engraver in the family. This is the first sort of little hint about what will be the great ambition of Parrot's life, which is to be an artist. The first hint, as they soon come to a what you would call a sort of printer's works, where counterfeiting is done and as is done today, books are reproduced without paying copyright to the authors, so they copy books from London and have them out cheaper on the roads and so on. So. I'll read you a little bit about Philadelphia, perhaps. Just a tiny bit. The books generally, I think its sort of tone is generally quite funny, I hope. This, just looking at it, feels rather dark and dire. It's really informed by two quite different views of the Eastern State Penitentiary, Tocqueville's and Charles Dickens. And it was really amazing to read, you know, these two completely different takes on it. And I'm really sort of indebted to both of them in this, because Dickens, of course, was appalled by it, and Tocqueville was actually rather admiring of its efficiency. So, I'm only reading it to you because it's Philadelphia. I haven't rehearsed it. I was the one, this is Parrot as they go to investigate, I was the one who should have been the French commissioner, I thought, following my duck-legged Aristo through the wicket gate of the Eastern State Penitentiary, passing between clipped privet hedges into the central chamber, from which seven long passages radiated like spokes on a Catherine wheel. On either side of every spoke was a long row of low cell doors. Twice he touched me on the arm as if in tenderness. Everything about us was silence, although sometimes the thick walls gave a muffled clue to the living nightmares they contained. The distant thuck of a weaver's shuttle, the ching of a hammer striking steel. But every one of those numbered double doors, first oak, then steel, was a human soul, a mind in its bone cage, the centre of its solar system, burning with regret and rage, condemned to silent, solitary labour, world without end. This spoked device was a machine of reform, it had been explained to the commissioner in the lifeless garden. We were shown a black hood and invited to try it on. How bloody kind. The hood is the crown given to every prisoner at the wicket gate. He enters blind. He does not see the garden. He shuffles along the penitential corridor to his cell, alone, in terror, not knowing if his next step will be to a deadly fall, if he is alone on earth or surrounded by others in a castle 10 miles long. This Eastern State Penitentiary is the work of the Quakers of Pennsylvania, who would not tear a man apart or pour molten lead into his intestines as was done by the bastard kings of old. Instead, they work direct upon the soul. I listened to Olivier de Garmont question the cost of construction. I was John Larratt, clown and secretaire, who'd already lived too long, who carried paper and carbon paper and a pen. The first poor devil we visitors was seated at his loom and never ceased his endless shuff and thump the entire time he spoke. He offered a grimace and a shrug and reminded me of one I love. He told us he'd always liked to dance. It was a joke. He shuffled his feet before his loom, and as his lordship's servants must once have collected moths and butterflies, I collected this conversation for his important book to be titled On the Penitentiary System in the United States and Its Application in France. It goes on. It doesn't get any funnier, that bit. maybe I should just finish with... I mean, as you can see, there's a lot of stuff happens in this book, and it's impossible to justify or explain it in a situation like this. So why don't I just read... We're sort of this far through the book, which I guess is about halfway through the book suddenly, and Olivier's sort of been pretty relentlessly horrid about what he sees, and in this little bit he's about to change his mind about the United States, but not really for any particularly intellectual reason. Let's see what happens. They're in New York. They've been invited to visit Mr. Peake, who is a banker. They've met on the ship, on the boat out. And Olivier is rather appalled that his servant has been invited as well, as has his servant's mistress and the mistress's mother. And that puts him in a very bad mood. It was not hot enough to make my nose bleed, but it was a very rough journey to Peake's Farm, which was located at what may have become by now, if the New York Commissioner's street plan has any real authority, land bordered by East 48th Street on the south and East 56th Street on the north. Emerging in bad temper from the wilderness, I found a silky driveway, a wooded ravine, a mature orchard, a clear, narrow, rocky stream running through native grasses. We rattled across a dam wall, came upon a rise from which we enjoyed the grand prospect across the East River to Blackwell's Island. Were my spirits lifted? Not really. Along the shores of a little cove grew a number of pretty trees in low situations, quite green, very still, and through the leaves the white sand of a beach. I viewed them rather sourly. When in a moment I beheld the Peake Mansion, I was pleased only because the size reduced the French, my French companions, to stunned silence. In the grand foyer I renewed my acquaintance with Mrs. Peake and her stringy daughters. "So," said Peake immediately, "we must take the tour." This, it appears, is the American custom, to escort one's visitors from room to room like an auctioneer. Even the meanest object will have some story, and the grandest ones, a price. I noted that the so-called library held no books. The furniture had been copied from engravings, and all the six paintings in the 34 rooms, three of them had been painted aboard the ship. And this was the home of one of New York's foremost citizens. The arches into the dining room were trimmed with green and autumn leaves. Entering, one was immediately confronted by a great number of vases also dressed with autumn leaves. Everything, in short, was very gay. The native flora was not, however, the room's chief decoration, for that was a friend of the two daughters, a Miss Godfrey, a visitor from Connecticut, who had clearly carried in her veins the triumph of those Vikings who had raided the British Isles so many centuries before, and whose miscegenation had produced such startling effects that 300 years later they had been the subject of those mad maps of hair colour bequeathed to my mother by her brother Astolf. Seeing Miss Godfrey, my opinion of New York was changed immediately. That a creature like this one should walk the earth, straw-haired, blue-eyed, straight-backed, tall, strong, like a goddess, but modest and gracious, perhaps even a little shy. At the meal, she was somehow placed between Mrs. Parrott and her mother, while the Peake girls regaled me with what I do not know. I gave these two girls all my full attention, noticing only that they both told me that Miss Godfrey was the daughter of Mr. Philip Godfrey, who sat on the board of the Wethersfield prison. What could be more perfect? There was food. We ate. There was piano and flute. The Miss Peake's voices had not improved since the ship. After dinner, I strolled with the master in his grounds, admiring his pigs and discussing my forthcoming trips to Philadelphia and Albany. So the best part of the afternoon was gone before I found myself walking with Miss Godfrey. How this happened, I have no idea. I was delighted, shocked that this impropriety should be so easily permitted, fearful that my companion would notice how far we had strayed from the terrace, where I noted Peake in deep conversation with Mrs. Parrott. I could not raise myself to protest. Around us was the American autumn in all its drunken wildness, like the colours of a savage and that impossible bird, the Antipodean cassowary, whose likeness Monsieur had sold to my mother while pretending it was a gift. Beyond the drive were carpets of green moss covered with red leaves. Miss Godfrey and I walked side by side, and now so far enough from the house that no soul could see us, she spoke to me quietly in French. Good Lord, what music, what an endearing way to speak. She was sorry she did not have her Molière so she could read, so I could read it to her as it should be read, not in her poor colonial voice. Was she flirting? To ask the question is to not understand her. She took each step as the first one of a dance. She kicked the red leaves and made them rise like birds. By the shoreline I saw Peake in close conversation with both parrots. What devilry he planned I could not say, nor could I hope to intercede. I had arrived quite unexpectedly. in paradise, enclosed by a landscape that no painter could portray. Before my eyes lay, or rather shone, magnificent New York. At every moment, steamships passed. America. That's a thank you. So, that's a sort of a simplification, but never mind. Because this argument exists until the very end, and if you don't read the very last page, you might not have read the book. And I would suggest Googling the dates. But the last words in the book is a date, and I suggest that you Google it. It's an extra added dimension to literature we've not had available before. So I think we might have some questions. Can we do that? And there are microphones, and if you just wait for the microphone to come. And
Mr. Carrier, yeah. Question. I finished the book last night. Very good. I came in late, and you did mention Sarah Palin, and the thing across my mind is we're in deep trouble, as I think de Tocqueville saw it at the time. You have, but in a different way, you had a character in the book, Algernon Watkins.
Mm-hmm.
What was your inspiration for that character, this man himself who's a victim of a Holocaust? And he's almost a man who seems not so much possessed, but he's just an artist who, I don't know if he sells himself at the end of the book. Huh. I mean, with Mathilde, the character in New York.
Okay.
Yeah. Is there a correspondence in real life to that person?
Well, there's Orbital, you know, the Birds of America.
Yeah.
And although when I began it, all I knew that Watkins really wanted, like Parrot also has, who's younger than he is, has this ambition. And to be an engraver, and Watkins is the engraver, and when Watkins suffers terribly in a fire, and this sort of madly burnt man turns up in the story later in New York, where he has begun to produce these splendid paintings of American and engravings of American birds. And when I was And so when I really began that, all I knew that I wanted to have that possibility. And I really wasn't thinking what the burning meant, and I wasn't really thinking about the end of the arc of his story would go. And I certainly had no idea that it would be so closely entwined with everything at the very end. But reading about the business of selling those sort of prints, as Audubon did, was very, very fruitful, and I stole little bits of information about the business of printmaking and selling and taking subscriptions, you know, from his life. So here the character is certainly clearly not Audubon, because life history is completely different, you know. But I drew on that, and I didn't think that he sold out at all. Yeah, very, very successful. If you were to do what Audubon did, you have to sell your work, and there's nothing, I don't think, that doesn't suggest that he's a failure or that the work that he produced was anything other than wonderful. But there are questions, of course, that the book raises at the end about the quality of art and an art market in a mercantile democracy. That's a question that sort of sits there, like it sits now here with us now, because we know these forces are at work in, you know, the art market and the literature market, and sometimes it means that things that only look like they might be art are called art, and where you can have a publisher, as I heard recently, talk seriously about a category of publishing which is faux literature. False literature, and talk about it seriously. So this is something that's marketed as literature that the people, no, really isn't literature at all, but the people reading it think is literature. And, well, Tocqueville, where are you? Anyway, thank you. Any other questions? Oh, come on. I had to go to Dallas to get here, yes.
I'm curious as to about your writing process. Are you the sort of person that maps it all out beforehand, or and when you begin the novel, do you know where it's going, especially in something like this, which is of a considerable length and depth, or do you figure it out as you go along?
Yes, no, yes, 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 no, no. it's all those things, as you might expect, I guess. That sounded like someone who might write occasionally. I begin with the idea of these two characters in opposition to each other. And I'm thinking way ahead and making notes, but mostly I'm really thinking about the very beginning. And I'm trying to, it feels to me sort of impossible to invent Olivier. How can I possibly begin to do this? You know, I don't speak French, I'm not an aristocrat, although I am, of course, of the spirit, but not in any other way. So that really, really, the first thing, the invention of Olivier and the first opening of the book really, really was the thing that frightened me the most, the thing that seemed most difficult, beyond one's reach, which I think are the most attractive things, really, in writing. And, you know, at the same time, I'm beginning to invent Parrot. But, you know, in my head, there are things, you know, like there's a convict ship to Australia here. One of the reasons all this is in Denver is so that there will have been this journey over Dartmoor, which will end up in Plymouth, where there's a convict ship, where the convict ships, you know. So I'm thinking the fact that the reason that it's Plymouth is because I'm going to have this trip to Australia, which is part of these things. So it happens a little bit at a time, but also all the time I'm, you know, reading and thinking about it and making notes, which I then lose or never look at again. And so it's a sort of a mess. I found the most gorgeous, I'm talking about Googling, I found a site online which is called Weird Maps. And in fact, I found this fantastically fanciful map of Australia, which is in the book, which invents very convincingly a whole sort of inland sea and things that are not there, but it does it with such authority. And so I had to incorporate that into the into the book. But I also found a map there which is turns out to be a sort of, it's this great convoluted thing like intestines, or and it's sort of red and yellow and it actually is a map of the changing path of the Mississippi at a certain part of the river, you know, when successive floods altered the banks. And so this is a map which is just a beautiful thing to look at. And although the people who made it really were thinking about the Mississippi, I thought it's exactly like writing a novel, you know, that you really know where you want to start, you know where you want to end up. And all these things and the ways you change your mind and the things you discover as you cut through the bank and go off in a slightly different direction. So a lot of chaos, a lot of planning, a lot of rational, calculated things, a lot of just trusting your instinct to, you know, fly blind and dumb in a way and let that happen. So everything. Continual anxiety. Churning. Yeah. There was someone here who was going to ask a sharp question. Who's that? There he is. He's not here. Yes.
There seems to be a lot of Dickens in your novels. Jack Maggs, for instance. And I wondered, did you read a lot of Dickens? And what other writers do you read? And did you read as a child?
Well, as a child, I read very, very little that's worth mentioning. Although, you know, Kipling, the Bible, that sort of thing. Not much. I never really read Dickens. I did finally because Jack Maggs is really about the character of Magwitch in Great Expectations, but that was drawn to my attention by Edward Said in Cultural Imperialism, who was writing about the character of Magwitch and his false consciousness that he, although he's free in Australia and he's become wealthy, he will go back to England, to the place that did everything to him in the first place at the risk of being hanged. So that was really, that seemed a very Australian story to me, and so then I had to start reading Dickens. But I'd been, people kept on mentioning Dickens in reviews of Illy Wacker and Oscar and Lucinda, and at times when I, you know, hadn't read Dickens at all. I don't know what people were really referring to. I think you know, great numbers of sort of minor characters in those early books had something to do with it. A lot of orphans, probably. These two men were once boys, and you know, and both of them, you know, the Trommer family is very huge. Like, you know, Olivier is not a orphan, but certainly Parrot is one more. So I think that gives it a slightly. There's a whole passage of the book which I'm really proud of, which is on Dartmoor. Which one reviewer at least said, yeah, I'm sort of really channeling Dickens. But if so, I wasn't thinking about Dickens, not for a second through all of that. But there's still, you know, the reader saw an echo of Magwitch and Pip in that journey, and that hadn't occurred to me. But it doesn't mean it's not there, and it's certainly there if a reader finds it there.
I'll be gentle.
A couple of things. This is the second novel in recent years that you've written where you have dueling voices.
Yeah.
That Theft also had the dueling voice thing going on. And it also struck me that there are a number of parallels with Theft as well about the nature, the discussion of the authenticity of art and forgery and reproduction. Mm. And particularly painting. And it seems that in recent years you've been particularly interested in that visual art. And I wondered if you could maybe, you know, talk about what the dueling voices allows you to do.
Yeah. Okay, so there's two things. There's the dueling voices and, yeah, and then the question about the art,
sure.
which I'll make a mess of, I think. But I'll,
okay.
The dueling voices, I mean, my first novels were normally told from numbers of different points of view. So, you know, if I really wanted to think about it, I think it was sort of that you'd have the action from this character's point of view, then this one, and then another one. And you're all seeing the same thing, but in truth, to be seen as a complicated business. And sometimes in thinking about it, I've thought of a cubist sort of truth which seems to make sense of. So I would still say, you know, ideally, I think that's what I should do. You know, have the many points of view. But you're right. In Theft, there are these two voices, and I really it was a sort of a discovery for me, and it really worked. And when I got to this book, I didn't think, oh, I've done this before. It didn't occur to me I'd done it before. But it's certainly the thing of having two voices in argument is certainly an attractive and interesting way to work. Sometimes you might want to have, I sometimes have a desire to get just another point of view in there, but you can do that within that structure, you know, like with a character telling a story or something like that. And the terrible thing about this is, this is a person who prides himself on never repeating himself, is that I'm writing another novel now and there are two voices. So whatever. The thing about visual art, well, I've always once liked to look at paintings and always felt that I haven't looked at paintings enough, and have over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years particularly, you know, taken a lot of pleasure in looking at paintings and thinking about them. But also I became friendly with a guy who had been a painter for many years, an abstract expressionist, and then finally became an art dealer. And he's a good friend, and he's a mischievous little fellow. And he's one of the few people. I mean, it's nice to have lunch with him. And I really like to talk about his business, and I like to talk about, to look at the appraisal documents and see people trying to pass off someone something as something, and backed by all this documentation that even an amateur like me can see is not so. And the physical business of painting and restoration is really, really interesting. So with Theft, one of the great, for me, the sort of the scary bit of that was writing from a painter's point of view about painting, which is something I'd said I would never do, that writers always screw up, and because they think it's like writing, and it's not. And so that was a thrill for me. It was almost like being a painter. You know, you do enough work, and you talk to enough conservators, and you talk to enough painters and museum people, and in the end, you'll do something that they believe. So it's almost like having made the painting yourself. So it's just a simple, I'm not thinking about why I'm doing it when I'm talking about this. I'm just sort of, it's a pleasure to be doing that. I think because I've perhaps got a little bit more confident about this, it's a way for me to talk about art without it being anything to do with literature, or not too much. It's fun. It's fun to be there. Yeah.
Was the true history of the Kelly Gang really true? Broader question, though. I mean, you obviously did a lot of research here. I know Kelly exists. My question has to do with, did you, by all the research, did you ever feel hamstrung by the truth and you want to take the fiction somewhere else?
Well, you see, from the very beginning of this idea, is that this is not Tocqueville. And, for instance, I talk about the French architectural historian who I worked with, researching the Tocqueville Chateau, and I've worked obsessively to understand it. And he did so much work, and it was such fun, too. And in the end, I took all of that knowledge, which he'd worked so hard to give me, and I sort of threw it on the floor and broke it, and assembled something that I wanted, that would fit what I wanted to do, but that I would be sort of deep in the knowledge that I'd gained, but I wasn't going to use it in the direct way. So it was not going to be Tocqueville's house. And later, of course, the very notion of the book is where you have Tocqueville going with Beaumont to America. Well, the minute there's a Beaumont character at the beginning who's called Blackfield, and he's killed. So the minute the Beaumont character is killed, you're clearly not dealing with that history, the Tocqueville history. But you also, I always would want to be, about the dates and what happened and that sort of thing of history, I would like to be correct. And, readers... I don't want people arguing with me about that. So I might as well get all that sort of stuff right. And we're with the Kelly Gang too. Everything that is known about Kelly is there. And what I was interested in inventing, most of the Kelly story is like a big black stage illuminated by like pencil thin lights. In those lights, we see the things that you know about Ned Kelly, which will either be a police report, a court appearance, then a couple of... And in the end, a great blaze of media attention to I think. We don't really know very much else. So for the novelist, it's perfect. I'm going to respect what you can see and what we know. And I'm going to think very hard about what might have happened in the darkness. And I'm going to try and do that responsibly. But recklessly, both. But I don't think that there's very little in true history of the Kelly Gang that could be contradicted by the record. But at the same time, it is a work of fiction. And when I say true history, I mean, what's that? Even that it doesn't have a "the" in there tells us something. It's sort of like a label that you might nail on a book. Glue to a box of nails in your workshop. True history of the Kelly Gang. So it's complicated. I really do try and respect the history, and I do absolutely defend and celebrate my right to invent at the same time. So I try to be a good person.
You wrote ad copy for a time, and I'm just curious, because that's to me anyway, because I'm a copywriter as well, a fascinating genre of writing or craft or whatnot, and what lessons did you take from that, if any, into the kind of writing you do now?
Hmm. Well, I became addicted to lunch. It's, you know, that of course writing copy involves using words, but it's, you know, so does all sorts of things involve using. If you're going to sell gloves in a department store, you're going to use words to do it, possibly. So I never really saw there were a lot of, and actually, and weirdly, the thing about the work at advertising, so little of it was to do with what you think of as writing copy. And it was much more to do with, you know, what you might call marketing and positioning of products and all that sort of things. I'm very pleased I don't have to think about anymore. Indeed, I can't watch a television commercial without thinking about all the 20-year-old young men in the office getting excited about something infantile. Anyway, like we did, you know, and what a peculiar little world it is. The great thing that advertising actually gave me was time to write, and I was good enough at it that as time went on, I worked less and less in advertising and more. So by 1976, when I'm putting my working life together in weird ways, like working for 5 days a month or, you know, two afternoons a week, I was able really to do 5 days, on average in a month, 5 days of writing every week of the year. And so I was able to do the one thing that every writer really needs to do, which is to write and write and write and write and write and write through all the garbage and keep writing. So advertising gave me that. I was often rather ashamed that that's what I did, and I was often rather angry. But I think now I was really blessed. There's one over here. Yeah.
First of all, thank you for coming to Philadelphia. It's really a treat. What country claims you? I mean, are you? Does Australia think of you as an Australian writer? Or
yeah, of course.
Do they? And
well, then they'll say I'm not. You know what families are like. It's and that's the right way to think about it. I think about me and my relationship with my country, and it is very familial. And so. There are one sometimes gets people who are upset that I've come to live here, but and now I've lived here for 20 years. So you know, for those of us that have lived like this, we know it's life isn't an either or thing. We might wish it to be, but it's not. And I often think living in New York, how when you walk down the street or you anywhere, that the streets are full of people with their hearts in two places, and. And maybe people with their hearts in places other than the place they're in, too. So I think this sort of pain and dislocation and curiosity is a modern condition. I didn't seek it. It's sort of, I stumbled into it as I stumble into most things rather carelessly. And here, 20 years later, here I am. But still, two passports. Are we done? Can I go home? Thank you very much. Thank you.
So which way do we go? Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.